in the flour, the grains. This is how, you know, people would use the hand mill. They didn't have, you know, processing machines like we have these days. And if you look at the pictures, or if you go to the east sometimes in the villages, you will still see that the hand mills are basically two stones of similar shape and size, which are placed on one another. And the difference is that the one which is on the top has a hole in between, in the middle of it. And the one which is in the bottom has actually an axis, you know, or a pillar. And the top one is placed in it, in that hole in between. Why is that axis important? Because when then they go around, you know, grinding the grains there, you know, the movement of the stone on the top will not be, the rotation will not be proper if that axis was missing. Otherwise, the stone at the top will go sideways here and there, and it will not work properly. Ali says, I am that pivotal, you know, position in Imamat. If you don't have that, then the system of Imamat and Khilafat will not be able to function properly or efficiently.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This week, we'll explore how the Palestinian Authority keeps trying to curry favour with elite decision makers in the US and UK, despite all the evidence that it just doesn't work. A recent example was when Mahmoud Abbas met with the US House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. The truth is, pro-Israel lobby groups are increasingly penetrating Western governments to starve the Palestinian Authority of cash. All its activities are being constrained down to the availability of school textbooks. As always, we'll be joined by expert guests to delve into the background of Israel's continuing colonization of Palestine and explore what can be done to stop it. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report on the Board of Deputies of British Jews and its part in the ongoing attack on the Palestinian Authority.
The Board of Deputies claims to only represent the Jewish community in Britain. But when digging a little deeper into its background, we find an organisation which lobbies governments on behalf of the Israeli regime. Today, we delve into the ways in which the BOD contributes to one of the Zionist entity's key aims of undermining the very Palestinian Authority which has served it so well. First, let us examine whether the Board of Deputies is in fact an Israel lobby group. The director of the Institute for Economic Affairs, Mark Littlewood, recently asked a pertinent question about the organisation.
The British Board of Jewish Deputies, do we think their list of donors should be in the public domain? What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, it's a very compelling answer, but you haven't answered the question, which is who funds you? You haven't named a single
organisation. Well, I told you why I won't answer the question. I don't believe that organisations...
It's quite convenient, isn't it?
Well, I don't think it is revealing. Do you think the list of donors to the British Board of Jewish Deputies should be listed in the public domain?
Are the British Board of Deputies lobbying government ministers on
this
and the other?
Yes,
in the same way that you are in quite a...
Well, more so. I mean, much richer than we are. The Church of England, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who does fund the Board of Deputies? Well, despite their opaque status, we were able to track down at least three. Trevor Chin, the well-known Israel lobbyist, funds the Board of Deputies alongside the Jerusalem Foundation and the JNF, which both build illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Chin is a vice president of the Jewish Leadership Council, which also pumps funds into the Board of Deputies. Another funder we are able to identify was the Katkin Puswillow Charitable Trust, which also funds the settlement building Jerusalem Foundation and the British Conservative Party. The senior vice president of the Board of Deputies, Gary Mond, recently resigned from his position after it came to light he had posted Islamophobic ideas online, notably that civilization was at war with Islam. He was simultaneously the honorary treasurer at the JNF, which boasts the prime minister of the Israeli regime as a patron. He has retained his position at the JNF despite his comments. The Board of Deputies was essential to the war against Corbynism in Britain and has worked closely with the Trevor Chin-funded Keir Starmer to further cleanse the Labour Party of pro-Palestinian actors. The Board of Deputies 2020 Trustees report boasts that the organisation enjoys a close working relationship with the Israeli Embassy in the UK and strengthened links with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the Israeli Defence Forces. It also boasts about lobbying other Arab governments and hosting events with the Israeli Embassy. In 2016, the Board of Deputies took credit for a decision of the British government changing its aid arrangement for the Palestinian Authority to providing the salaries of health and education public servants on a vetted list only. The Board of Deputies, which has a history of editing textbooks in the UK, also welcomed the EU's report criticising the Palestinian Authority's school curriculum in 2021. Several Israel lobby groups, including the Board of Deputies, are working to change the material which Palestinian children study, and their main target is the Palestinian Authority. So the question we must ask, why are Israel lobby groups, including the Board of Deputies, working against the Palestinian Authority, which has bent over backwards for the Zionist entity?
To discuss the Board of Deputies and its relations with Israel, we're joined today by two expert guests. Mo Haider was renowned for his sharp-witted and eloquent commentary about Arsenal Football Club. But last year, he was axed from the popular Arsenal Fans TV channel after appearing on air wearing a Palestine badge on his hoodie. AFTV said claims that he was sacked because of this were baseless. He's joined by our regular programme expert, David Miller, who's an academic and former professor at Bristol University, as well as being the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Welcome to the show. Mo, can I come to you first, if I can? Now, you were dismissed from AFTV for showing your support for Palestine. Can you just tell us what happened?
Yeah, well, I mean, unfortunately, during the pandemic, we were filming remotely from home, and prior to the pandemic, doing it in person. Now, prior to the pandemic, I wore a badge on a jacket, and that said Free Palestine. The channel took exception to that, asked me to remove the word free because it was a political statement, which I thought, fine, I can understand they don't want politics on their channel, wasn't happy. But I censored the word free, and it displayed that censorship, and I thought, OK, fine, that's dealt with. Things took a more sinister turn and a turn for the worse when we were filming remotely and I was just wearing a hoodie and it just has a Palestine badge, almost like a football emblem in a way, on the chest. And then one day logged on to the portal where we were doing the filming and I was asked to remove the hoodie. And I was really surprised. I was quite upset, to be honest with you. And when I questioned as to why I should remove that hoodie and whether the same treatment would have been levied to me if that was a hoodie that said, for example, England, you know, I was just told, all right, just forget it, let's just crack on with it. When I inquired more, I actually found out that apparently threats had been received of legal action against AFTV on the basis of me wearing that hoodie. And just to be clear, all it said was Palestine. It had red, green, white and black.
Yeah, and, I mean, were the Board of Deputies involved in any way in this whole affair?
Not at that point, but the way the Board of Deputies became involved is that when things came to a head, when Palestine was attacked, you know, a few months ago, I publicly called out AFTV because I was frankly really resentful about the treatment that I had received. Yeah. So I called them out on social media and said, when are you going to stop being complicit in the suppression? Because all of these microaggressions are forms of suppression. To just remove this Palestine badge here or remove this, you know, little signs of Palestine from different areas. When that happened and I called them out, they then kicked me off the channel. They didn't like the fact that I had done that. And in response to that, they made some claims about me and I wanted to clear the air. So I released quite a long, comprehensive video. Yeah. And as part of that, I wanted to really hammer down the fact that they found the Palestine badge or the hoodie that I was wearing to be not appropriate for their platform, yet a video that had been uploaded to their platform and that actually made them aware of this contained a really crude, vulgar, anti-Semitic remark. I contacted the Board of Deputies for British Jews to ask them on their opinion and their advice as to whether I should share that video or just refer to that video, because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't causing offence to the Jewish population that would watch the video that I released. So that's when they became involved.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, particularly in light of all the flag waving that we're seeing for Ukraine at the moment. Mm. But David, I mean, I wondered if whether you could just tell us a bit more about the involvement of the Board of Deputies in pro-Israel lobbying. And I understand that Tal Offer, who's a senior figure in the Board of Deputies, has been quite instrumental in some of this stuff. Maybe you could just expand on that a bit more for us.
Well, the Board, historically, for most of its existence, for centuries now, was an anti-Zionist organisation. It only became Zionist in 1939. But it's become, since then, it's become a very prominent lobbyist for the Israeli state and has been very active along with a whole range of other groups which we would identify as being pro-Israel lobby groups. I mean, the Board of Deputies sort of poses as being just a communal body to represent Jewish people in general. It's more than that, and it says this in its report, as we saw in the report there, that they actually talk about their active collaboration with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. That's the ministry tasked by the Israeli government for undermining BDS and Palestine solidarity activities all over the world. So there's a very strong relationship there between the Israeli government and the Board of Deputies, which is contrary to what they say they do. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there are many interesting people in the Board of Deputies. We saw one there, and there's been a number of others who have been accused, found guilty of Islamophobic activities. But yeah, the role of Tal Offer is an interesting one. This is a guy who's an Israeli who came over here, did a degree, went back to Israel, worked for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Right.
And then back in this country, he has been since 2012 at least, involved in trying to stir up what effectively became the witch hunt in 2015 when Jeremy Corbyn was elected. He's been involved in many occasions trying to smear pro-Palestine activists as being anti-Semitic. And one of the key things that he did in 2014-15 was he was core to the infrastructure of pro-Israel groups, which subsequently was at the forefront of attacking Jeremy Corbyn. So he's had a very key role in British politics and isn't widely known.
No, indeed. I just wondered about whether I could ask you, I mean, were you surprised by what happened to you and how did it make you feel, you know, when you were booted off the channel?
Well, you made reference to Jeremy Corbyn there. I wasn't surprised because I knew there'd be a response. It's a very emotive, sensitive issue. And when I publicly called them out, that was off the back of a lot of things that had happened privately. Yeah. So I wasn't surprised. I saw that it could potentially, that could happen, that I would be kicked off. But in terms of how it made me feel, I just felt frustrated. You know, I think the double standards, the hypocrisy is what annoys so many people, including myself, where, you know, there were other contributors to the channel that wore emblems or text of different countries. Mm. And this was just that.
No,
so
indeed,
it was that hypocrisy that made me feel very upset. Yeah, yeah. But ultimately, it's not about me. I'm just a tiny speck, you know, tiny drop in the ocean. I just wanted to really highlight to people that if that's what's happened to me, it's such an irrelevant level on a fan channel. What happens to the people who are right at the top?
I wonder if you could just say a bit. I mean, I think you've been in communication with Tal Offer that David mentioned. Just tell us a little bit about that, if you can, briefly.
And I will be respectful of the fact that it was a conversation not in the public domain, so I'll respect him on that basis. But when I contacted the British or the Board of Deputies for British Jews, it was actually Tal Offer that I communicated with, and I asked him for his opinion on whether I should share the video or not. And I think the thing that upsets me and that I find really frustrating is that I, in good faith, went to them because I hoped that they do what it says on the tin. You know, this is for British Jews. Never in my wildest imaginations or I expected them to be sort of masquerading in that sense, where they're actually looking after the interests or have the interests of the Israeli government in their minds or in their hearts. Yeah. And, I feel quite let down by that and misled.
Indeed. Well, look, I mean, we'll come back and talk in a moment after we've just seen this report on the Palestinian Authority's response to the campaigns against it.
When we see the Palestinian Authority meeting with American political leaders like the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in Ramallah recently, the question arises about the efficacy of the strategy of the Palestinian Authority. U.S. political leaders are not likely to support the Palestinians in the foreseeable future. Instead, they will facilitate the normalization of the Zionist entity. In this, they will walk in lockstep with the agents and assets of the Zionist movement. But the liberation of Palestine will require that Zionism in Palestine and around the world be dismantled. One of the key assets of the Zionist regime in the UK is the Board of Deputies of British Jews. Though it presents itself as purely a communal Jewish group, it recently admitted to enjoying, quote, a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy in the UK and has strengthened links. But it doesn't just lobby for Israel. It also actively targets the Palestinian Authority. Here's how. The BOD has been active in trying to censor and manipulate school textbooks on Palestine in the UK. In that case, it worked with the UK Lawyers for Israel, a lobby group with close links to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Despite their best efforts, Palestine campaigners have reversed this institutional bias. The BOD has campaigned to undermine the school curriculum of the Palestinian Authority as part of a wider EU effort to target the PA, despite a UN-funded study concluding that Palestinian textbooks adhere to UNESCO standards. The BOD has supported the EU and UK government in slashing funding to the Palestinian Authority despite its servility to the Israeli regime. Dismantling Zionism in Palestine will also require that it's dismantled in the UK, the US, and worldwide.
Well, what did you make of that report, David? I mean, do you think the Palestinian Authority is underestimating the range of forces that are against it?
Yeah, I think that people recognise that the Palestinian Authority is in a difficult position. And they also are, especially in Palestine, very frustrated by its lack of progress, of a proper response to the Israeli government. And some people talk even of collaboration. And I think that there's some arguments around that which are worthy of consideration. But it seems to me that one of the problems is that they haven't really understood that the need to target Zionism as an actually functioning ideology, meaning the Israeli regime in Palestine, but also the worldwide Zionist movement, which, of course, has really quite strong links, especially in this country and in the US and other countries, with government. The Palestinian Authority is never going to trump that influence, and so we need to focus in particular on dismantling Zionism as an ideology and, indeed, in dismantling every single Zionist organisation across the world, not just the Zionist organisations in Israel.
I mean, how do you think we should respond, though? I mean, this conflation between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. I mean, that's a real problem, isn't it?
Well, that's been the key weapon of choice that the Israelis and the Zionist movement more broadly have used in the last 5 or 6 years against the left, against Muslims in the US, in France and Germany, and, of course, in the UK. Mm. And we need, of course, to push back against that. Anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Many anti-Zionists are Jewish, of course, and there are many Zionists who themselves are not Jewish. Yeah. So there is no clear relationship between Judaism and Zionism, sure. Although, of course, the Israeli government wants to suggest that there is.
Indeed. And what about this Alex Brummer character, who is a very senior figure in the Board of Deputies? Tell us a bit about him.
Well, this is one of many examples which we've come across in this programme before, that Brummer is involved with the Board of Deputies, but that's not his main job. He works his main job in the Daily Mail. He's a very senior journalist in the Daily Mail. But at the same time, he has this role at the Board of Deputies. That's a clear structural conflict of interest, which, you know, in any other circumstance, people will be pointing out and saying is a problem. But it's not only that. He's also the chair of this thing, I don't know if you've come across it, called the Abraham Initiatives.
Right.
And this is an organisation which is funded by the Israeli government and is set up to foster closer relationships between Israeli institutions and other organisations around the world. So it's a very strong and clear Israel lobby group. And this is a guy who, when he was writing in the Daily Mail during the Corbyn period, was writing articles attacking Corbyn. And he's not the only person who was doing that, not the only person who had Zionist conflicts of interest. And it's, of course, not only Zionists in the press who will write pro-Israel stuff, but this is an actual issue that you've got people who have particular political commitments which are not genuinely disclosed, and that results in them writing stories in the paper which are inimical to the interests of a large section of the population.
Mm. You've come up against the Zionist movement, haven't you, in your work on Arsenal Football Club? I mean, do you think that we should be doing more to highlight the role of the Israel lobby? I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
I think Israel lobby, or any lobby, are very influential parts of society in this day and age, especially in the US. We see that with lobbies, really being quite influential. So I think transparency is what the principle is here. And it doesn't really matter what lobby it is. Where society is going to be vastly influenced by a lobby, I want that transparency as a member of that society. So I think that's what it comes down to, that principle.
Mm. I mean, a lot of people, are fearful, I think, about speaking out, aren't they? In relation to support for Palestine, in relation to, indeed, calling out, for example, the board of British Jews. What's your thoughts about, how do we kind of overcome that fear? I mean, clearly, you were very loud and proud in your support for Palestine. I mean, what sort of message would you give to people who do feel cowed by, the range of the forces which are thrown at them?
It's really hard because at a point you have to decide whether you're making a sacrifice. And for me, I felt as though it was worth it. I feel passionately enough to say that if certain doors close to me, then so be it. I think it's just about doing the right thing and what sort of conviction you have in your belief that is essential to your day-to-day existence, doing that right thing. So if you do feel that passionately, great. But where people's livelihoods are affected, it's a really, really tough choice. My message would just be that, wherever possible, try and do that right thing.
No, indeed. And, I mean, David, I mean, have you got any sort of personal experience of the Board of Deputies? You smile, wry smile there. I guess you probably have. I mean, perhaps you could share that with us.
I was recently sacked from my job at the University of Bristol, which was the result of a 3-year-long campaign by the Zionist movement, in which the Board of Deputies played a role, along with, a virtual shopping list of pro-Israel lobby groups, which most people, I guess, won't even have heard the names of. I mean, a huge number of different organisations were involved in the attempt to have me sacked, and they were successful in the end. So, I mean, the Board of Deputies is one of those organisations, but this is a set of organisations which work together. I mean, if you look at this take a step back and look at the Zionist movement itself in this country. I mean, if you look only at the ones which are formerly members of organisations which are part of the World Zionist Organisation, there's over 200 of those in the UK, and that doesn't even include the Board of Deputies or the Jewish Leadership Council or the Labour Friends of Israel or any of those organisations. So there are literally hundreds of organisations whose mission is to defend Israel and to promote Israel. And so, we face a quite an uphill task to bring that out into the public domain, to allow people to see the magnitude of the efforts put into defending Israeli settler colonialism and ethnic cleansing, which goes on day by day. And so we have a huge a road ahead of us. But I think we're now beginning to see clearly that this is a significant threat, not just to British democracy, but to world peace, and needs to be seriously taken on. And that's the next steps. People need to see clearly what the Zionist movement is and how then to dismantle it.
I mean, I must say, I was elected to Parliament in 2010, and I was quite surprised by the influence of the Zionist lobby in Parliament. All the political parties, actually. Mm-hmm. I've got a huge cohort of members of Parliament who are, Labour friends of Israel, Conservative friends of Israel, and so on. And I mean, just in your case, David, I understand a very senior Conservative, Robert Jenrick, didn't he, intervene with a view to trying to get you dismissed from your post? I mean, this is almost unprecedented, isn't it?
Well, it wasn't just him. There were a number of ministers, a number of MPs. I think there were 88 parliamentarians signed a letter against me. There were select committee sessions. There were all sorts of direct interventions with the university, the local MPs. My Labour MP, of course, was part of that process of having me sacked. So, yes, I mean, this was an assault by, what should we say, almost the entire British establishment at the behest, in the end, of assets of the State of Israel. So that's a pretty extraordinary set of affairs. And it took that kind of effort for them to intimidate the University of Bristol into sacking me, which is what happened.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I guess, Mo, you know, given what's happened to you and to David there, I mean, it just shows, I suppose, doesn't it, the power of the Zionist lobby. But I think, would you agree that, knowledge is power? The more that we can actually expose the role of the Zionist lobby, hopefully that might give people confidence. Briefly, if you could maybe just comment on that.
Absolutely, and I think that especially what's going on in this current situation with Russia and Ukraine, a lot of people are seeing parallels. And, whilst we all wish for the best outcome there for the Ukrainians, in this day and age, especially with the rise of social media as well, I think there's a bit more unfiltered reporting and unfiltered images and videos that people are being able to see. I think that's a key task to continue that in order to fight against this.
Indeed. Well, listen, thanks very much indeed to both of you. I think that's been a really interesting discussion. OK, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. I've been Chris Williamson. Bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The racist undertones and overtones of much Western coverage, with commentators and interviewees regularly stressing how Ukrainian refugees are European, civilized, blonde-haired and blue-eyed, is hard to miss, says Jonathan Cook, journalist, in an article published under the heading Russia-Ukraine. Western media are acting as cheerleaders for war. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. It is simply astonishing how many Western journalists, including BBC reporters, are shamelessly fawning over young women building Molotov cocktails on the streets of Ukrainian cities like Kiev. It's suddenly attractive to make improvised explosives, at least if the media consider you white, European, and civilized. That might surprise other, more established resistance movements, especially in the West Asia region. They have invariably found themselves tarred as terrorists for doing much the same. Western journalists' difficulty containing their identification with and support for Ukraine's civilian resistance must be maddening to Palestinians in tiny Gaza, for example, who have been locked into a metal cage by an Israeli regime military occupier for decades. Palestinians in Gaza have also suffered a trade blockade by the Zionist regime for the past 15 years, one designed to put them on a starvation diet. Protesters, including women, children, and people in wheelchairs, have regularly turned out to throw a stone in the direction of distant Israeli snipers, hidden behind fortifications, as a symbolic way to demand their freedom. These protesters have often been shot by the Zionist regime army in response. The Western media offer occasional anguish at the lives lost or the legs amputated of those targeted by the snipers. But none of them cheerlead this Palestinian resistance as they do the Ukrainian one. More usually, the protesters are treated as dupes. Gaza, unlike Ukraine, does not have an army, and its fighters, unlike Ukraine's, are not being armed by the West. The Guardian newspaper even censored its cartoonist Steve Bell when he sought to depict one of the victims of the Zionist regime's snipers, a nurse, Razan Najjar, who had been trying to help the wounded. The paper implied that the cartoon of Britain's then Prime Minister, Theresa May, welcoming her Israeli counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu, to London, with Najjar, a sacrificial victim behind them, in the first place, was anti-Semitic. Assuming the media has in the past been reluctant to encourage ordinary people to confront well-armed troops so as to avoid civilian casualties, then why has that policy suddenly been ditched in Ukraine? The double standards are glaring and everywhere. It is impossible to claim that the journalists doing this are ignorant of reporting conventions elsewhere. They're mostly veterans of the West Asia region war zones, well used to covering Gaza, Baghdad, Nablus, Aleppo, and Tripoli. Britain and other European states have chosen to fuel the fires of resistance in Ukraine by sending it weapons that can only lead to greater loss of life, especially of civilians caught in the crossfire. One might have expected the British media to examine the ethical implications of such a policy and the hypocrisy, but not a bit of it. In fact, much of the media have not only been acting as lobbyists for more weapons to be sent to the Ukrainian army, they have whipped up support for civilians in the UK to get more involved in the fighting. That has been the case even after number 10 distanced itself from comments by Liz Truss, the foreign secretary, that Britons should be encouraged to volunteer for Ukraine's so-called international legion, supposedly to defend Europe. Her position was in conflict with usual government practice, which has treated those heading off to fight in war zones in the West Asia region as terrorists. Shamima Begum, who went to Syria aged 15, has been stripped of her British citizenship and denied the right to return for doing what Truss has proposed in Ukraine, Nonetheless, that did not dissuade the BBC from travelling to Essex to meet DeVosa, a supplier of surplus British Army kit he has been selling cheaply to Ukrainians in Britain so they can head off to the battlefront. Voza was shown tearing off Union Jack insignia from uniform so Ukrainian militia men could use them. Compare that with the treatment of an entirely peaceful form of resistance by Westerners in solidarity with the Palestinians, their national boycott, sanctions and divestment BDS movement. It has been treated as barely better than terrorism, with bans on support for BDS across Europe and the US. It is hard to remember in all the media agitation over Ukraine that this sympathetic coverage flies in the face of its reporting conventions. It is inconceivable, of course, that Britain would ever send arms to help, for example, Gaza liberate itself. For that reason, the media will never have the opportunity to exercise their vocal cords in outrage at such a development. In fact, the Western media more typically echo Western government opposition to any support for Gaza, even construction materials like cement, to rebuild the enclave after one of the Zionist regime's intermittent wrecking sprees. That is because reporters treat uncritically the Zionist regime claims that humanitarian aid will be repurposed by some groups and bolster terrorism. Back in 2010, for example, BBC Panorama program failed to mention that an Israeli regime naval attack on a humanitarian aid convoy to besieged Gaza was conducted illegally in international waters. 9 activists trying to deliver aid items like medicine to Gaza aboard the Mavi Marmara ship were killed by the Zionist regime commandos. But the interviews with these masked men were largely uncritical. There was very little sympathy from the BBC for that act of resistance against a brutal occupier. A year earlier, the BBC broke with tradition and refused to broadcast a long-established aid appeal because on this occasion it was to provide food and shelter to Gaza following Israeli regime assault that destroyed swathes of the enclave. The BBC justified the decision on the grounds that it would compromise its impartiality, something it seems entirely unconcerned about in Ukraine. The BBC had not responded to questions about these inconsistencies by the time of publication.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-azam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We were talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And I'm going to start this question or this episode with this question, Sheikh Javid. You know, when we are dealing with the congregational prayer, you know, there is always an imam, in fact, in front of the people, right?
Yeah.
And this congregational prayer leader or imam, should he, you know, what should he say, in fact, in his intention before attempting the congregational prayer? And should he perform it with the intention of a congregational prayer or individual prayer?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it is up to him to choose whether he, you know, leads the congregational prayer and informs his intention according to the congregation which he's going to lead.
Mm-hmm.
Or he can offer his individual prayer and others will follow him simply. The congregational prayer will be in order no matter what the intention of the prayer leader is. Okay, mm-hmm. So if the prayer leader is offering his prayer, other people can choose to join him and stand behind him and make niyyah of jama'at. So their congregational prayers will be okay. There will be no objection to other people because other people make the niyyah or the intention of jama'at, while the individual in himself, the prayer leader himself, actually offers his regular prayer. But it is better for him, according to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, to form his intention and to make niyyah of jama'ah. Okay, he can make it because niyyah is a matter of the heart. It's a matter of the mind, actually. Mm-hmm. You just pass it through your mind and make that and form that intention, and you will gain the sawab of jama'ah, because you see, everything depends on the intention, of course. And even if you do not have that intention, because you are leading the prayer, the sawab is there. Because
right.
When there are two people offering prayers together, of course, the sawab or the reward for that prayer will be multiplied.
I see. If an individual, in fact, starts his prayer.
Yes.
And he doesn't have that kind of intention, as you said, to be the leader of a congregational prayer.
Sure.
All right? Like of a community, for example, at a mosque. Just somebody, imagine that, an individual, just in front of the mosque, starts saying the prayer.
Yeah.
And he obviously doesn't have that kind of intention in mind to have, a group of people behind him.
Yes.
He just starts saying the prayer, and some people think that he's the leader, and they come and join and fill the ranks.
Good.
All right?
Yes.
So are these people's prayers valid? And what happens to the individual himself?
Of course, it's correct to say that the people offering prayer behind a given person, okay, an individual who is known to other people, is valid, you know. And what is actually important in the congregational prayer is to make sure that the prayer leader has an unblemished character.
Mm-hmm.
He is just, and he is, his actions, his behavior, and everything.
He has positive and perfect character attributes and characteristics.
No. Yes. Justice is a very important attribute,
right,
that he must enjoy. And it's very much important, and it's also very much essential for every individual to make sure that the prayer leader
mm-hmm.
has an unblemished character. He is just, and he does not, and he's not known for something which is indecent or sinful,
Okay.
That's important.
Yes.
And of course, there are some other conditions which I think we have discussed in the previous episodes. But I just for the audience, I would like to mention that the prayer leader must be Shia. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Must be a 12-year Shia. He must be sane. He must be adult. He must be legitimate by birth,
mm-hmm.
and he must be just. Okay.
Right. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of prayer according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. We were talking about the congregational prayer leader and his intention, Sheikh Javid. You know, but some people are very much conservative, right?
Yes, you're right.
And they are sensitive. They take it very hard on themselves. And just out of, the sensitivity that they have or conservation that they have,
yes,
they don't want to become the prayer leader, for example. And if somebody doesn't want that,
yes,
like
you're right,
in his intention, in other words, he's not
he does not consent to being led.
Exactly. It doesn't agree, or his consent is not with the congregational prayer.
You're right.
And suddenly he sees a group of people behind him. What can he do? And are the prayers of those individuals behind the prayer leader okay, valid?
You're right. Of course,
if he's not happy.
Yes, it has been clearly stated in the Risala authored by Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei that the consent and permission of the prayer leader is not a requirement.
Uh-huh.
So it's not necessary for mu'mineen to,
yes,
get the consent and permission of the person who they are going to stand behind, okay? So they can follow him, they can stand behind him and offer their jama'ah prayer. Whether the prayer leader consents to it or does not, okay, as long as you are certain that the prayer leader has the full meets or fulfills the requirements, the necessary requirements, there is no objection to you following him in the congregational prayer.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh, and I hope that everybody enjoyed this episode of the Islamic Laws. And thank you for listening to this program. We were talking about the rules of prayer and the jurisprudential statuses of the congregational prayer and the intention of the imam or the leader of the congregational prayer in this episode. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. And if you have any questions and queries, you can drop your comments or whatever you think of the program at englishradio@irib.ir. And you can also search us by Googling and searching the title of the program, that is Islamic Laws, and plus English Radio. And then you can very easily find us. You can't miss us. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir La ilaha illa hum Wahidun Qadirun Muhyin Mumitun Al-Zahir Wal-Batin La ilaha illa hum La ilaha illa hum.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.